and exchanged a long look, one of those in which long-married couples are capable of carrying out complete conversations in the space of a few heartbeats. At last, Jenny tilted her head a bit to one side. Ian smiled and took her hand. "It'll be all right, Mun Yindu," he said to her in a low, tender voice. Then he turned to Jamie.
"Aye, take him. It'll be a great chance for the lad." "You're sure?"
Jamie hesitated, speaking to his sister rather than Ian. Jenny nodded. Her blue eyes glistened in the lamplight, and the end of her nose was slightly red.
"I suppose it's best we give him his freedom while he still thinks it's ours to give," she said.
She looked at Jamie, then at me, straight and steady.
"But you'll take good care of him, eh?"
Chapter 39. Lost, and by the wind grieved. This part of Scotland was as unlike the leafy glens and lochs near Lallybroch as the North Yorkshire moors. Here there were virtually no trees, only long sweeps of rock-strewn heather rising into crags that touched the lowering sky and disappeared abruptly into curtains of mist. As we got nearer to the seacoast, the mist became heavier, setting in earlier in the afternoon, lingering longer in the morning, so that only for a couple of hours in the middle of the day did we have anything like clear riding. The going was consequently slow, but none of us minded greatly, except young Ian, who was beside himself with excitement, impatient to arrive.
"How far is it from the shore to the Seal's Island?" he asked Jamie for the tenth time.
"A quarter mile, I make it," his uncle replied.
"I can swim that far," young Ian repeated, for the tenth time.
His hands were clenched tightly on the reins, and his bony jaw set with determination.
"Aye, I know you can," Jamie assured him patiently.
He glanced at me, the hint of a smile hidden in the corner of his mouth.
"You will not need to, though. Just swim straight for the island, and the current will carry you."
The boy nodded and lapsed into silence, but his eyes were bright with anticipation. The headland above the cove was mist-shrouded and deserted. Our voices echoed oddly in the fog, and we soon stopped talking out of an abiding sense of eeriness. I could hear the seals barking far below, the sound wavering and mixing with the crash of the surf, so that now and then it sounded like sailors hallooing to one another over the sound of the sea. Jamie pointed out the rock chimney of Ellen's tower to young Ian, and taking a coil of rope from his saddle, picked his way over the broken rock of the headland to the entrance.
"Keep your shirt on till you're down," he told the lad, shouting to be heard above the wave, "else the rock will tear your back to shreds."
Ian nodded understanding. Then the rope tied securely round his middle gave me a nervous grin, took two jerky steps, and disappeared into the earth. Jamie had the end of the rope wrapped round his own waist, paying out the length of it carefully with his sound hand as the boy descended. Crawling on hands and knees, I made my way over the short turf and pebbles to the crumbling edge of the cliff, where I could look over to the half-moon beach below. It seemed a very long time, but finally I saw Ian emerge from the bottom of the chimney, a small ant-like figure. He untied his rope, peered around, spotted us at the top of the cliff, and waved enthusiastically. I waved back, but Jamie merely muttered,
"All right, get on then," under his breath.
I could feel him tense beside me as the boy stripped off to his breeks and scrambled down the rocks to the water, and I felt his flinch as the small figure dived headlong into the grey-blue waves.
"Brrr,"
I said, watching. "The water must be freezing."
"It is," Jamie said with feeling. "Ian's right. It's a vicious time of year to be swimming."
His face was pale and set. I didn't think it was the result of discomfort from his wounded arm, though the long ride and the exercise with the rope couldn't have done it any good. While he had shown nothing but encouraging confidence while Ian was making his descent, he wasn't making any effort to hide his worry now. The fact was that there was no way for us to reach Ian should anything go wrong.
"Maybe we should have waited for the mist to lift," I said,
more to distract him than because I thought so.
"'If we had till next Easter, we might,' he agreed ironically. "'Though I'll grant you, I've seen it clearer than this,' he added, squinting into the swirling murk below. The three islands were only intermittently visible from the cliff as the fog swept across them. I'd been able to see the bobbing dot of Ian's head for the first 20 yards as he left the shore, but now he had disappeared into the mist.
"'Do you think he's all right?'
Jamie bent to help me scramble upright. The cloth of his coat was damp and rough under my fingers, soaked with mist and the fine droplets of ocean spray.
"'Aye, he'll do. He's a bonny swimmer, and it's none so difficult to swim either, once he's into the current.'
Still, he stared into the mist as though sheer effort could pierce its veils. On Jamie's advice, young Ian had timed his descent to begin when the tide began to go out, to have as much assistance as possible from the tide race. Looking over the edge, I could see a floating mass of bladder wrack, half-stranded on the widening strip of beach.
"'Perhaps 2 hours before he comes back,'
Jamie answered my unspoken question. He turned reluctantly from his vain perusal of the mist-hidden cove.
"'Damn! I wish I'd gone myself, arm or no arm.'
"'Both young Jamie and Michael have done it,' I reminded him. He gave me a rueful smile.
"'Oh, aye. Ian will do fine. It's only that it's a good deal easier to do something that's a bit dangerous than it is to wait and worry while someone else does it.'
"'Huh!' I told him. "'So now you know what it's like being married to you.'
He laughed. "'Oh, aye, I suppose so. Besides, it would be a shame to cheat young Ian of his adventure. Come on, then, let's get out of the wind.'
We moved inland a bit, away from the crumbling edge of the cliff, and sat down to wait, using the horses' bodies as shelter. Rough, shaggy Highland ponies, they appeared unmoved by the unpleasant weather, merely standing together, heads down, tails turned against the wind. The wind was too high for easy conversation. We sat quietly, leaning together like the horses with our backs to the windy shore.
"'What's that?'
Jamie raised his head, listening.
"'What?'
"'I thought I heard something.'
"'I expect it's the seals,' I said. But before the words were out of my mouth, he was up and striding toward the cliff's edge. The cove was still full of curling mist, but the wind had uncovered the seals' island and it was clearly visible, at least for the moment. There were no seals on it now, though. A small boat was drawn up on a sloping rock shelf at one side of the island. Not a fisherman's boat. This one was longer and more pointed at the prow, with one set of oars. As I stared, a man appeared from the centre of the island. He carried something under one arm, the size and shape of the box Jamie had described. I didn't have long to speculate as to the nature of this object, though, for just then a second man came up the far slope of the island and into sight. This one was carrying young Ian. He had the boy's half-naked body slung carelessly over one shoulder. It swung head down, arms dangling with a limpness that made it clear the boy was unconscious or dead.
"Ian!"
Jamie's hand clamped over my mouth before I could shout again.
"Hush!"
He dragged me to my knees to keep me out of sight. We watched, helpless, as the second man heaved Ian carelessly into the boat, then took hold of the gunwales to run it back into the water. There wasn't a chance of making the descent down the chimney and the swim to the island before they succeeded in making their escape.
But escape to where?
"Where did they come from?" I gasped. Nothing else stirred in the cove below save the mist and the shifting kelp beds turning in the tide.
"A ship. It's a ship's boat."
Jamie added something low and heartfelt in Gaelic, and then was gone. I turned to see him fling himself on one of the horses and wrench its head around. Then he was off, riding hell for leather across the headland, away from the cove. Rough as the footing across the headland was, the horses were shod for it better than I was. I hastily mounted and followed Jamie, a high-pitched whinny of protest from Ian's hobbled mount ringing in my ears. It was less than a quarter of a mile to the ocean side of the headland, but it seemed to take forever to reach it. I saw Jamie ahead of me, his hair flying loose in the wind, and beyond him, the ship, lying to offshore.
The ground broke away in a tumble of rock that fell down to the ocean, not so steep as the cliffs of the cove, but much too rough to take a horse down. By the time I had reined up, Jamie was off his horse and picking his way down the rubble toward the water. To the left, I could see the longboat from the island pulling round the curve of the headland. Someone on the ship must have been looking out for them, for I heard a faint hail from the direction of the ship and saw small figures suddenly appear in the rigging. One of these must also have seen us, for there was a sudden agitation aboard, with heads popping up above the rail and more yelling. The ship was blue, with a broad black band painted all around it. There was a line of gun ports set in this band, and as I watched, the forward one opened and the round black eye of the gun peeked out.
"Jamie!" I shrieked as loudly as I could.
He looked up from the rocks at his feet, saw where I was pointing, and hurled himself flat in the rubble as the gun went off. The report wasn't terribly loud, but there was a sort of whistling noise past my head that made me duck instinctively. Several of the rocks around me exploded in puffs of flying rock chips, and it occurred to me, rather belatedly, that the horses and I were a great deal more visible there at the top of the headland than Jamie was on the cliff below. The horses, having grasped this essential fact long before I did, were on their way back to where we had left their hobbled fellow well before the dust had settled. I flung myself bodily over the edge of the headland, slid several feet in a shower of gravel, and wedged myself into a deep crevice in the cliff. There was another explosion somewhere above my head, and I pressed myself even closer into the rock. Evidently the people on board the ship were satisfied with the effect of their last shot, for relative silence now descended. My heart was hammering against my ribs, and the air around my face was full of a fine grey dust that gave me an irresistible urge to cough. I risked a look over my shoulder, and was in time to see the longboat being hoisted aboard ship. Of Ian and his two captors, there was no sign. The gun port closed silently as I watched, and the rope that held the anchor slithered up, streaming water. The ship turned slowly, seeking wind. The air was light, and the sails barely puffed, but even that was enough. Slowly, then faster, she was moving toward the open sea. By the time Jamie had reached my roosting place, the ship had all but vanished in the thick cloud bank that obscured the horizon. "Jesus," was all he said when he reached me, but he clutched me hard for a moment. "Jesus." He let go then, and turned to look out over the sea. Nothing moved save a few tendrils of slow-floating mist. The whole world seemed stricken with silence. Even the occasional cries of the Mers and Shearwaters had been cut off by the cannon's boom. The grey rock near my foot showed a fresh patch of lighter grey, where shot had struck off a wide flake of stone. It was no more than 3 feet above the crevice where I had taken refuge. What shall we do? I felt numbed, both by the shock of the afternoon and by the sheer enormity of what had happened. Impossible to believe that in less than an hour Ian had disappeared from us as completely as though he had been wiped off the face of the earth. The fog bank loomed thick and impenetrable, a little way off the coast before us, a barrier as impassable as the curtain between earth and the underworld. My mind kept replaying images. The mist, drifting over the outlines of the Silky's Island, the sudden appearance of the boat, the men coming over the rocks. Ian's lanky, teenaged body, white-skinned as the mist, skinny limbs dangling like a disjointed doll's. I had seen everything with that clarity that attends tragedy. Every detail fixed in my mind's eye to be shown again and again, always with that half-conscious feeling that this time I should be able to alter it. Jamie's face was set in rigid lines, the furrows cut deep from nose to mouth. "I don't know," he said. "Damn me to hell, I don't know what to do." His hands flexed suddenly into fists at his sides. He shut his eyes, breathing heavily. I felt even more frightened at this admission. In the brief time I'd been back with him, I had grown once more accustomed to having Jamie always know what to do, even in the direst circumstances. This confession seemed more upsetting than anything that had yet happened. A sense of helplessness swirled round me like the mist. Every nerve cried out to do something. But what? I saw the streak of blood on his cuff, then. He had gashed his hand climbing down the rocks. That I could help, and I felt a sense of thankfulness that there was, after all, one thing I could do, however small. "You've cut yourself," I said. I touched his injured hand. "Let me see. I'll wrap it for you."
"No," he said.
He turned away, face strained, still looking desperately out into the fog. When I reached for him again, he jerked away.
"No," I said. "Leave it be."
I swallowed hard and wrapped my arms about myself under my cloak. There was little wind now, even on the headland, but it was cold and clammy nonetheless. He rubbed his hand carelessly against the front of his coat, leaving a rusty smear. He was still staring out to sea, toward the spot where the ship had vanished. He closed his eyes and pressed his lips tight together. Then he opened them, made a small gesture of apology toward me, and turned toward the headland.
"I suppose we must catch the horses," he said quietly. "Come on."
This ends Disc 20. Voyager, Disc 21.
We walked back across the thick, short turf and strewn rocks without speaking, silent with shock and grief. I could see the horses, small, stick-legged figures in the distance, clustered together with their hobbled companion. It seemed to have taken hours to run from the headland to the outer shore. Going back seemed much longer. "I don't think he was dead," I said, after what seemed like a year. I laid a hand tentatively on Jamie's arm, meaning to be comforting, but he wouldn't have noticed if I'd struck him with a blackjack. He walked on slowly, head down.
"No," he said,
and I saw him swallow hard.
"No, he wasn't dead, or they'd not have taken him."
"Did they take him aboard the ship?" I pressed. "Did you see them?" I thought it might be better for him if he would talk. He nodded.
"Aye, they passed him aboard. I saw it clear. I suppose that's some hope," he muttered, as though to himself. "If they didn't knock him on the head at once, maybe they won't."
Suddenly remembering that I was there, he turned and looked at me, eyes searching my face.
"You're all right, Sasnach?"
I was scraped raw in several places, covered with filth and shaky-kneed with fright, but basically sound. "I'm fine." I put my hand on his arm again. This time he let it stay.
"That's good," he said softly after a moment.
He tucked my hand into the crook of his elbow, and we went on. "Have you any idea who they were?" I had to raise my voice slightly to be heard above the wash of the surf behind us, but I wanted to keep him talking if I could. He shook his head, frowning. The effort of talking seemed to be bringing him slowly out of his own shock.
"I heard one of the sailors shout to the men in the boat, and he spoke in French. But that proves nothing. Sailors come from everywhere. Still, I've seen enough of ships at the docks to think that this one didn't have quite the look of a merchant. Nor the look of an English ship at all," he added, "though I couldn't see why exactly. The way the sails were rigged, maybe."
"It was blue, with a black line painted round it," I said. "That was all I had time to see before the guns started firing." Was it possible to trace a ship? The germ of the idea gave me hope. Perhaps the situation wasn't so hopeless as I had first thought. If Ian wasn't dead, and we could find out where the ship was going. "Did you see a name on it?" I asked.
"A name?"
He looked faintly surprised at the notion.
"What, on the ship?"
"Do ships not usually have their names painted on the sides?" I asked.
"No. What for?"
He sounded honestly puzzled. "So you could bloody tell who they are," I said, exasperated. Taken by surprise by my tone, he actually smiled a little.
"Aye,
Well, I should expect that perhaps they dinna much want anyone telling who they are, given their business, he said dryly.
We paced on together for a few moments, thinking. Then I said curiously, Well, but how do legitimate ships tell who each other is if they haven't got names painted on? He glanced at me, one eyebrow raised.
I should know you from another woman, he pointed out, and you haven't got your name stitched upon your bosom.
Not so much as a letter A, I said flippantly. But seeing his blank look, added, You mean ships look different enough, and there are few enough of them that you can tell one from another just by looking?
Not me, he said honestly. I know a few ships where I ken the captain and have been aboard to do business. Or a few like the packet boats that go back and forth so often that I've seen them in port dozens of times. But a sailing man would ken a great deal more.
Then it might be possible to find out what the ship that took Ian is called. He nodded, looking at me curiously.
Aye, I think so. I've been trying to call to mind everything about it as we walked, so as to tell Jared. He'll know a great many ships, and a great many more captains, and perhaps one of them will know a blue ship wide in the beam with 3 masts, 12 guns, and a scowling figurehead.
My heart bounded upward. So you do have a plan?
I wouldn't call it so much a plan, he said. It's only I can't think of anything else to do.
He shrugged and wiped a hand over his face. Tiny droplets of moisture were condensing on us as we walked, glistening in the ruddy hairs of his eyebrows and coating his cheeks with a wetness like tears. He sighed.
The passage is arranged from Inverness. The best I can see to do is to go. Jared will be expecting us in Le Havre. When we see him, perhaps he can help us to find out what the blue ship is called and maybe where it's bound.
Aye, he said dryly, anticipating my question. Ships have home ports, and if they dinna belong to the Navy, they have runs they commonly make and papers for the harbour master too, showing where they're bound.
I began to feel better than I had since Ian had descended Ellen's Tower.
If they're not pirates or privateers, that is, he added,
with a warning look which put an immediate damper on my rising spirits. And if they are?
Then God knows, but I don't, he said briefly,
and wouldn't say any more until we reached the horses. They were grazing on the headland near the tower where we'd left Ian's mount, behaving as though nothing had happened, pretending to find the tough seagrass delicious.
Jamie viewed them disapprovingly. Silly beasts.
He grabbed the coil of rope and wrapped it twice round a projecting stone. Handing me the end with a terse instruction to hold it, he dropped the free end down the chimney, shed his coat and shoes, and disappeared down the rope himself without further remark. Some time later he came up, sweating profusely, with a small bundle tucked under his arm. Young Ian's shirt, coat, shoes and stockings, with his knife and the small leather pouch in which the lad kept such valuables as he had.
"Do you mean to take them home to Jenny?" I asked.
I tried to imagine what Jenny might think, say or do at the news, and succeeded all too well. I felt a little sick, knowing that the hollow, aching sense of loss I felt was as nothing to what hers would be. Jamie's face was flushed from the climb, but at my words the blood drained from his cheeks. His hands tightened on the bundle.
"Oh, aye," he said,
very softly, with great bitterness.
"Aye, I shall go home and tell my sister that I've lost her youngest son." She didn't want him to come with me, but I insisted. "I'll take care of him," I said. "And now he's hurt and maybe dead, but here are his clothes to remember him by."
His jaw clenched and he swallowed convulsively.
"I'd rather be dead myself," he said.
He knelt on the ground then, shaking out the articles of clothing, folding them carefully and laying them together in a pile. He folded the coat carefully around the other things, stood up, and stuffed the bundle into his saddlebag. "Ian will be needing them, I expect, when we find him," I said, trying to sound convinced. Jamie looked at me, but after a moment he nodded.
"Aye," he said softly, "I expect he will."
It was too late in the day to begin the ride to Inverness. The sun was setting, announcing the fact with a dull, reddish glow that barely penetrated the gathering mist. Without speaking, we began to make camp. There was cold food in the saddlebags, but neither of us had the heart to eat. Instead, we rolled ourselves up in cloaks and blankets and lay down to sleep, cradled in small hollows that Jamie had scooped in the earth. I couldn't sleep. The ground was hard and stony beneath my hips and shoulders, and the thunder of the surf below would have been sufficient to keep me awake, even had my mind not been filled with thoughts of Ian. Was he badly hurt? The limpness of his body had bespoken some damage, but I'd seen no blood. Presumably, he had merely been hit on the head. If so, what would he feel when he woke to find himself abducted and being carried farther from home and family with each passing minute? And how were we ever to find him? When Jamie had first mentioned Jared, I had felt hopeful, but the more I thought of it, the slimmer seemed the prospects of actually finding a single ship, which might now be sailing in any direction at all to any place in the world. And would his captors bother to keep Ian? Or would they, on second thoughts, conclude that he was a dangerous nuisance and pitch him overboard? I didn't think I slept, but I must have dozed, my dreams full of trouble. I woke shivering with cold and edged out a hand reaching for Jamie. He wasn't there. When I sat up, I found that he had spread his blanket over me while I dozed, but it was a poor substitute for the heat of his body. He was sitting some distance away, with his back to me. The offshore wind had risen with the setting of the sun and blown some of the mist away. A half moon shed enough light through the clouds to show me his hunched figure clearly. I got up and walked over to him, folding my cloak tight about me against the chill. My steps made a light crunching sound on the crumbled granite, but the sound was drowned in the sighing rumble of the sea below. Still, he must have heard me. He didn't turn around, but gave no sign of surprise when I sank down beside him. He sat with his chin in his hands, his elbows on his knees, eyes wide and sightless as he gazed out into the dark water of the cove. If the seals were awake, they were quiet tonight. "Are you all right?" I said quietly. "It's beastly cold." He was wearing nothing but his coat, and in the small, chilled hours of the night, in the wet, cold air above the sea, that was far from enough. I could feel the tiny, constant shiver that ran through him when I set my hand on his arm. "Aye, I'm fine," he said, with a marked lack of conviction. I merely snorted at this piece of prevarication and sat down next to him on another chunk of granite. "It wasn't your fault," I said, after we had sat in silence for some time, listening to the sea. "You should go and sleep, Sassenach." His voice was even, but with an undertone of hopelessness that made me move closer to him, trying to embrace him. He was clearly reluctant to touch me, but I was shivering very obviously myself by this time. "I'm not going anywhere." He sighed deeply and pulled me closer, settling me upon his knee so that his arms came inside my cloak, holding tight. Little by little, the shivering eased. "What are you doing out here?" I asked at last.
"Praying," he said softly. "Or trying to."
"I shouldn't have interrupted you." I made as though to move away, but his hold on me tightened.
"No, stay," he said.
We stayed clasped close. I could feel the warmth of his breathing in my ear. He drew in his breath as though about to speak, but then let it out without saying anything. I turned and touched his face. "What is it, Jamie?"
"Is it wrong for me to have you?" he whispered.
His face was bone white, his eyes no more than dark pits in the dim light.
"I keep thinking,
Is it my fault? Have I sinned so greatly, wanting you so much, needing you more than life itself? Do you?
I took his face between my hands, feeling the wide bones cold under my palms. And if you do, how can that be wrong? I'm your wife. In spite of everything, the simple word wife made my heart lighten. He turned his face slightly so his lips lay against my palm, and his hand came up, groping for mine. His fingers were cold too, and hard as driftwood soaked in seawater.
I tell myself so. God has given you to me. How can I not love you? And yet, I keep thinking, and canna stop.
He looked down at me then, brow furrowed with trouble.
The treasure. It was all right to use it when there was need to feed the hungry or to rescue folk from prison. But to try to buy my freedom from guilt, to use it only so that I might live free at Lallybroch with you and not trouble myself over Lyra, I think maybe that was wrong to do.
I drew his hand down around my waist and pulled him close. He came, eager for comfort, and laid his head on my shoulder.
Hush, I said to him, although he hadn't spoken again. Be still.
Jamie, have you ever done something for yourself alone, not with any thought of anyone else? His hand rested gently on my back, tracing the seam of my bodice, and his breathing held the hint of a smile.
Oh, many and many a time, he whispered. When I saw you, when I took you, not caring did you want me or no, did you have someone else to be, someone else to love. Bloody man, I whispered in his ear, rocking him as best I could.
You're an awful fool, Jamie Fraser. And what about Brianna?
That wasn't wrong, was it? No.
He swallowed. I could hear the sound of it clearly and feel the pulse beat in his neck where I held him.
But now I've taken you back from her as well. I love you, and I love Ian like he was my own. And I'm thinking maybe I cannot have you both.
Jamie Fraser, I said again, with as much conviction as I could put into my voice, you're a terrible fool. I smoothed the hair back from his forehead and twisted my fist in the thick tail at his nape, pulling his head back to make him look at me. I thought my face must look to him as his did to me, the bleached bones of a skull with the lips and eyes dark as blood. You didn't force me to come to you or snatch me away from Brianna. I came because I wanted to, because I wanted you as much as you did me, and my being here has nothing to do with what's happened. We're married, blast you, by any standard you care to name. Before God, man, Neptune, or what have you.
Neptune? He said, sounding a little stunned.
Oh, be quiet, I said. We're married, I say, and it isn't wicked for you to want me or to have me, and no God worth his salt would take your nephew away from you because you wanted to be happy. So there.
Besides, I added, pulling back and looking up at him a moment later, I'm not bloody going back. So what could you do about it anyway?
The small vibration in his chest this time was laughter, not cold.
Take you and be damned for it, I expect, he said.
He kissed my forehead gently.
Loving you has put me through hell more than once, Sasnach. I'll risk it again if need be.
Bah, I said. And you think loving you's been a bed of roses, do you? This time he laughed out loud.
No, he said, but you'll maybe keep doing it.
Maybe I will at that.
You're a very stubborn woman, he said,
the smile clear in his voice.
It bloody takes one to know one, I said.
And then we were both quiet for quite some time. It was very late, perhaps 4 o'clock in the morning. The half moon was low in the sky, seen only now and then through the moving clouds. The clouds themselves were moving faster. The wind was shifting and the mist breaking up in the turning hour between dark and dawn. Somewhere below, one of the seals barked loudly once.
"Do you think perhaps you could stand to go now?" Jamie said suddenly. "Not wait for the daylight. Once off the headland, the going's none so bad that the horses canna manage in the dark."
My whole body ached from weariness, and I was starving. But I stood up at once and brushed the hair out of my face. "Let's go," I said. Part 8. On the Water. Chapter 40. I shall go down to the sea.
"It'll have to be the Artemis."
Jared flipped shut the cover of his portable writing desk and rubbed his brow, frowning. Jamie's cousin had been in his 50s when I knew him before and was now well past 70, but the snub-nosed hatchet face, the spare, narrow frame and the tireless capacity for work were just the same. Only his hair marked his age, gone from a lank darkness to a scanty, pure and gleaming white, jauntily tied with a red silk ribbon.
"She's no more than a mid-sized sloop with a crew of 40 or so," he remarked. "But it's late in the season, and we'll no likely to do better. All of the Indiamen will have gone a month since. Artemis would have gone with a convoy to Jamaica, was she not laid up for repair." "I'd sooner have a ship of yours, and one of your captains," Jamie assured him. "The size doesn't matter."
Jared cocked a sceptical eyebrow at his cousin.
"Oh, well, and you may find it matters more than you think out at sea. It's like to be squally this late in the season, and a sloop will be bobbing like a cork. Might I ask how you weathered the channel crossing in the packet boat, cousin?"
Jamie's face, already drawn and grim, grew somewhat grimmer at this question. The completest of landlubbers, he wasn't just prone to seasickness, but prostrated by it. He had been violently ill all the way from Inverness to Le Havre, though sea and weather had been quite calm. Now, some 6 hours later, safe ashore in Jared's warehouse by the quay, there was still a pale tinge to his lips and dark circles beneath his eyes.
"I'll manage," he said shortly.
Jared eyed him dubiously, well aware of his response to seagoing craft of any kind. Jamie could scarcely set foot in a ship at anchor without going green. The prospect of his crossing the Atlantic, sealed inescapably in a small and constantly tossing ship for 2 or 3 months, was enough to boggle the stoutest mind. It had been troubling mine for some time.
"Well, I suppose there's no help for it," Jared said with a sigh, echoing my thought. "And at least you'll have a physician to hand," he added, with a smile at me. "That is, I suppose you intend accompanying him, my dear?"
"Yes, indeed," I assured him. "How long will it be before the ship is ready? I'd like to find a good apothecary's to stock my medicine chest before the voyage." Jared pursed his lips in concentration.
"A week, God willing," he said. "Artemis is in Bilbao at the moment. She's to carry a cargo of tan Spanish hides with a load of copper from Italy. She'll ship that here once she arrives, which should be the day after tomorrow with a fair wind. I've no captain signed on for the voyage yet, but a good man in mind. I may have to go to Paris to fetch him, though, and that will be 2 days there and 2 back, and a day to complete stores, fill the water casks, add all the bits and pieces, and she should be ready to leave at dawn tomorrow week." "How long to the West Indies?" Jamie asked.
The tension in him showed in the lines of his body, little affected either by our journey or by the brief rest. He was strung taut as a bow, and likely to remain so until we had found young Ian.
2 months and the season," Jared replied,
the small frown still lining his forehead.
"But you're a month past the season now. Hit the winter gales and it could be 3. Or more.
Or never." But Jared, ex-seaman that he was too superstitious or too tactful to voice this possibility. Still, I saw him touch the wood of his desk surreptitiously for luck. Neither would he voice the other thought that occupied my mind. We had no positive proof that the blue ship was headed for the West Indies. We had only the records Jarrett had obtained for us from the Le Havre harbour master, showing two visits by the ship, aptly named Bruja, within the last 5 years, each time giving her home port as Bridgetown on the island of Barbados.
"Tell me about her again, the ship that took young Ian," Jarrett said. "How did she ride, high in the water, or sunk low as if she were loaded heavy for a voyage?"
Jamie closed his eyes for a moment, concentrating, then opened them with a nod.
"Heavy laden, I could swear it. Her gun ports were no more than 6 feet from the water."
Jarrett nodded, satisfied.
"Then she was leaving port, not coming in. I've messengers out to all the major ports in France, Portugal and Spain. With luck, they'll find the port she shipped from, and then we'll know her destination for sure from her papers."
His thin lips quirked suddenly downward.
"Unless she's turned pirate and sailing under false papers, that is."
The old wine merchant carefully set aside the lap desk, its carved mahogany richly darkened by years of use, and rose to his feet, moving stiffly.
"Well, that's the most that can be done for the moment. Let's go to the house now. Mathilde will have supper waiting. Tomorrow I'll take you over the manifests and orders, and your wife can find her bits of herbs."
It was nearly 5 o'clock, and full dark at this time of year, but Jarrett had two linksmen waiting to escort us the short distance to his house, equipped with torches to light the way and armed with stout clubs. Le Havre was a thriving port city, and the Quay district was no place to walk alone after dark, particularly if one was known as a prosperous wine merchant. Despite the exhaustion of the channel crossing, the oppressive clamminess and pervasive fish smell of Le Havre, and a gnawing hunger, I felt my spirits rise as we followed the torches through the dark, narrow streets. Thanks to Jarrett, we had at least a chance of finding young Ian. Jarrett had concurred with Jamie's opinion that if the pirates of the Bruja, for so I thought of them, hadn't killed young Ian on the spot, they were likely to keep him unharmed. A healthy young male of any race could be sold as a slave or indentured servant in the West Indies for upward of £200, a respectable sum by current standards. If they did intend so to dispose of young Ian profitably, and if we knew the port to which they were sailing, it should be a reasonably easy matter to find and recover the boy. A gust of wind and a few chilly drops from the hovering clouds dampened my optimism slightly, reminding me that while it might be no great matter to find Ian once we had reached the West Indies, both the Bruja and the Artemis had to reach the islands first, and the winter storms were beginning. The rain increased through the night, drumming insistently on the slate roof above our heads. I would normally have found the sound soothing and soporific. Under the circumstances, the low thrum seemed threatening, not peaceful. Despite Jared's substantial dinner and the excellent wines that accompanied it, I found myself unable to sleep, my mind summoning images of rain-soaked canvas and the swell of heavy seas. At least my morbid imaginings were keeping only myself awake. Jamie hadn't come up with me, but had stayed to talk with Jared about the arrangements for the upcoming voyage. Jared was willing to risk a ship and a captain to help in the search. In return, Jamie would sail as supercargo.
"As what?" I had said, hearing this proposal. "The supercargo," Jarrett had explained patiently. "That's the man whose duty it is to oversee the loading, the unloading, and the sale and disposition of the cargo. The captain and the crew merely sail the ship. Someone's got to look after the contents. In a case where the welfare of the cargo will be affected, the supercargo's orders may override even the captain's authority."
And so it was arranged. While Jarrett was more than willing to go to some risk in order to help a kinsman, he saw no reason not to profit from the arrangement. He had therefore made quick provision for a miscellaneous cargo to be loaded from Bilbao and Le Havre. We would sail to Jamaica to unload the bulk of it, and would arrange for the reloading of the Artemis with rum produced by the sugarcane plantation of Fraser A.C. on Jamaica for the return trip. The return trip, however, wouldn't occur until good sailing weather returned in late April or early May. For the time between arrival on Jamaica in February and return to Scotland in May, Jamie would have disposal of the Artemis and her crew to travel to Barbados, or other places, in search of young Ian. 3 months. I hoped it would be enough. It was a generous arrangement. Still, Jared, who had been an expatriate wine seller for many years in France, was wealthy enough that the loss of a ship, while distressing, wouldn't cripple him. The fact didn't escape me that while Jared was risking a small portion of his fortune, we were risking our lives. The wind seemed to be dying. It no longer howled down the chimney with quite such force. Sleep proving still elusive, I got out of bed and, with a quilt wrapped round my shoulders for warmth, went to the window. The sky was a deep mottled grey, the scudding rain clouds edged with brilliant light from the moon that hid behind them, and the glass was streaked with rain. Still, enough light seeped through the clouds for me to make out the masts of the ships moored at the quay, less than a quarter of a mile away. They swayed to and fro, their sails furled tight against the storm, rising and falling in uneasy rhythm as the waves rocked the boats at anchor. In a week's time, I would be on one. I hadn't dared to think what life might be like once I had found Jamie, lest I not find him after all. Then I had found him, and in quick succession had contemplated life as a printer's wife among the political and literary worlds of Edinburgh. A dangerous and fugitive existence as a smuggler's lady. And finally, the busy, settled life of a Highland farm, which I had known before and loved. Now, in equally quick succession, all these possibilities had been jerked away, and I faced an unknown future once more. Oddly enough, I wasn't so much distressed by this as excited by it. I had been settled for 20 years, rooted as a barnacle by my attachments to Brianna, to Frank, to my patients. Now fate and my own actions had ripped me loose from all those things, and I felt as though I were tumbling free in the surf at the mercy of forces a great deal stronger than myself. My breath had misted the glass. I traced a small heart in the cloudiness, as I had used to do for Brianna on cold mornings. Then I would put her initials inside the heart, B-E-R, for Brianna Ellen Randall. Would she still call herself Randall? I wondered. Or Fraser now? I hesitated, then drew 2 letters inside the outline of the heart, a J and a C. I was still standing before the window when the door opened, and Jamie came in. "Are you awake still?" he asked, rather unnecessarily. "The rain kept me from sleeping." I went and embraced him, glad of his warm solidness to dispel the cold gloom of the night. He hugged me, resting his cheek against my hair. He smelt faintly of seasickness, and much more strongly of candle wax and ink. "Have you been writing?" I asked. He looked down at me in astonishment. "I have. But how did you know that?" "You smell of ink." He smiled slightly, stepping back and running his hand through his hair. "You've a nose as keen as a truffle pig, Sassenach." "Why, thank you. What a graceful compliment," I said. "What were you writing?" The smile disappeared from his face, leaving him looking strained and tired. "A letter to Jenny," he said. He went to the table where he shed his coat and began to unfasten his stock and jabot. "I didn't want to write her until we'd seen Jared and I could tell her what plans we had and what the prospects were for bringing Ian home safe." He grimaced and pulled the shirt over his head. "God knows what she'll do when she gets it. And thank God I'll be at sea when she does," he added wryly, emerging from the folds of linen. It couldn't have been an easy piece of composition, but I thought he seemed easier for the writing of it. He sat down to take off his shoes and stockings, and I came behind him to undo the clubbed queue of his hair.
"I'm glad the writing's over, at least," he said, echoing my thought. "I've been dreading telling her more than anything else."
"You told her the truth?" He shrugged.
"I always have."
"Except about me." I didn't voice the thought, though, but began to rub his shoulders, kneading the knotted muscles. "What did Jared do with Mr. Willoughby?" I asked, massage bringing the Chinese to mind. "He had accompanied us on the Channel crossing, sticking to Jamie like a small blue silk shadow. Jared, used to seeing everything on the docks, had taken Mr. Willoughby in stride, bowing gravely to him and addressing him with a few words of Mandarin. But his housekeeper had viewed this unusual guest with considerably more suspicion. 'I believe he's gone to sleep in the stable.' Jamie yawned and stretched himself luxuriously. 'Mathilde said she wasn't accustomed to have heathens in the house, and didn't mean to start now. She was sprinkling the kitchen with holy water after he ate supper there.'" Glancing up, he caught sight of the heart I had traced on the window pane, black against the misted glass, and smiled.
"What's that?"
"Just silliness," I said. He reached up and took my right hand, the ball of his thumb caressing the small scar at the base of my own thumb, the letter J he had made with the point of his knife just before I left him, before Culloden.
"I did not ask," he said, "whether you wished to come with me. I can leave you here. Jared will have you stay with him and welcome, here or in Paris. Or you could go back to Lallybroch if you wished."
"No, you didn't ask," I said, "because you knew bloody well what the answer would be." We looked at each other and smiled. The lines of heartsickness and weariness had lifted from his face. The candlelight glowed softly on the burnished crown of his head as he bent and gently kissed the palm of my hand. The wind still whistled in the chimney, and the rain ran down the glass like tears outside. But it no longer mattered. Now I could sleep. The sky had cleared by morning. A brisk cold breeze rattled the window panes of Jared's study, but couldn't penetrate to the cosy room inside. The house at Le Havre was much smaller than his lavish Paris residence, but still boasted three stories of solid, half-timbered comfort. I pushed my feet farther toward the crackling fire and dipped my quill into the inkwell. I was making up a list of all the things I thought might be needed in the medical way for a two-month voyage. Distilled alcohol was both the most important and the easiest to obtain. Jared had promised to get me a cask in Paris.
"We'd best label it something else, though," he told me, "or the sealers will have drunk it before you've left port."
"Purified lard," I wrote slowly. "St. John's wort, garlic, £10. Yarrow." I wrote borage, then shook my head and crossed it out, replacing it with the older name by which it was more likely known now, Buglas. It was slow work. At one time I had known the medicinal uses of all the common herbs, and not a few uncommon ones. I had had to. They were all that was available. At that, many of them were surprisingly effective. Despite the scepticism and outspoken horror of my supervisors and colleagues at the hospital in Boston, I had used them occasionally on my modern patients to good effect. "Did you see what Dr. Randall did?" a shocked intern's cry echoed in memory, making me smile as I wrote. "She fed the stomach in 134B boiled flowers." The fact remained that one wouldn't use yarrow and comfrey on a wound if iodine were available, nor treat a systemic infection with bladderwort in preference to penicillin. I had forgotten a lot, but as I wrote the names of the herbs, the look and the smell of each one began to come back to me. The dark look and pleasant light smell of birch oil, the sharp tang of the mint family, the dusty, sweet smell of chamomile and the astringency of bistort. Across the table, Jamie was struggling with his own lists. A poor penman, he wrote laboriously with his crippled right hand, pausing now and then to rub the healing wound above his left elbow and mutter curses under his breath.
"Have you lime juice on your list, Sassenach?" he inquired, looking up.
"No. Ought I to have?" He brushed a strand of hair out of his face and frowned at the sheet of paper in front of him.
"It depends. Customarily, it would be the ship's surgeon who provides the lime juice. But in a ship the size of the Artemis, there generally isn't a surgeon, and the provision of foodstuffs falls to the purser. But there isn't a purser either. There's no time to find a dependable man, so I shall fill that office too."
"Well, if you'll be purser and supercargo, I expect I'll be the closest thing to a ship's surgeon," I said, smiling slightly. "I'll get the lime juice."
"All right."
We returned to a companionable scratching, unbroken until the entrance of Josephine, the parlour-maid, to announce the arrival of a person. Her long nose wrinkled in unconscious disapproval at the information.
"He waits upon the doorstep. The butler tried to send him away, but he insists that he has an appointment with you, Monsieur James."
The questioning tone of this last implied that nothing could seem more unlikely, but duty compelled her to relay the improbable suggestion. Jamie's eyebrows rose.
"A person? What sort of person?"
Josephine's lips primmed together as though she really couldn't bring herself to say. I was becoming curious to see this person, and ventured over to the window. Sticking my head far out, I could see the top of a very dusty black slouch hat on the doorstep, and not much more. "He looks like a peddler. He's got a bundle of some kind on his back," I reported, craning out still further, hands on the sill. Jamie clutched me by the waist and drew me back, thrusting his own head out in turn.
"Och, it's the coin dealer Jared mentioned," he exclaimed. "Bring him up, then."
With an eloquent expression on her narrow face, Josephine departed, returning in short order with a tall, gangling youth of perhaps 20, dressed in a badly outmoded style of coat, wide unbuckled breeches that flapped limply about his skinny shanks, drooping stockings, and the cheapest of wooden sabots. The filthy black hat, courteously removed indoors, revealed a thin face with an intelligent expression, adorned with a vigorous, if scanty, brown beard. Since virtually no one in Lav, other than a few seamen, wore a beard, it hardly needed the small, shiny black skullcap on the newcomer's head to tell me he was a Jew. The boy bowed awkwardly to me, then to Jamie, struggling with the straps of his peddler's pack.
"Madame," he said, with a bob that made his curly sidelocks dance. "Monsieur, it is most good of you to receive me."
He spoke French oddly, with a sing-song intonation that made him hard to follow. While I entirely understood Josephine's reservations about this person, still he had wide, guileless blue eyes that made me smile at him, despite his generally unprepossessing appearance.
"It is we who should be grateful to you," Jamie was saying. "I had not expected you to come so promptly. My cousin tells me your name is Meyer."
The coin dealer nodded, a shy smile breaking out amid the sprigs of his youthful beard.
"Yes, Meyer. It is no trouble. I was in the city already." "Yet you come from Frankfurt, no?" "A long way," Jamie said politely.
He smiled as he looked over Meyer's costume, which looked as though he had retrieved it from a rubbish tip.
"And a dusty one, too, I expect," he added. "Will you take wine?"
Meyer looked flustered at this offer, but after opening and closing his mouth a few times, finally settled on a silent nod of acceptance. His shyness vanished, though, once the pack was opened. Though from the outside the shapeless bundle looked as though it might contain at best a change of ragged linen and Meyer's midday meal, once opened, it revealed several small wooden racks, cleverly fitted into a framework inside the pack, each rack packed carefully with tiny leather bags, cuddling together like eggs in a nest. Meyer removed a folded square of fabric from beneath the racks, whipped it open, and spread it with something of a flourish on Jamie's desk. Then, one by one, Maya opened the bags and drew out the contents, placing each gleaming round reverently on the deep blue velvet of the cloth.
"An aquilea,"